It's out of here! Home run, Lenny Dykstra!
Stairs rips one into the night, deep into right, way out of here.
The Phillies win the game on a base hit by Mitch Williams at 4:40 in the morning.
Swing and a miss, struck him out. It's wacky, wonderful. Bunch of throwbacks has won the National League pennant.
Welcome to Continued Success, your weekly look back at the Phillies of 2009, starting this week. That's what we're going to be doing here on Continued Success. I'm Liz Rocher of Yahoo Sports, and with me is the head guy over at The Good Fight, Justin Clue. How are you?
Hello. Doing better with every day we get closer to baseball.
Oh, thank God. Thank God. We are going to jump in and talk about the most exciting thing to happen to me all offseason. But before that, I wanted to talk a little bit about the other most exciting thing is Bryce Harper hitting 2 home runs today.
Oh, did we all see that? Did we all see that Bryce Harper hit 2 home runs in one game today? That was illuminating. I don't know. I feel like this deal could really work out in the Phillies' favor, personally.
One of them literally left the stadium.
Liz, let me ask you this. How many home runs did Mike Trout hit for the Phillies today?
0.
Yeah.
That number is going to stay 0 for a long time. Thank God.
What? It sucks that we're so excited about Mike Trout not being on the Phillies. I don't want anyone to get it wrong. I'm not excited that he's not on the Phillies because I don't want him on the Phillies. Every baseball team, every fan of every baseball team should want Mike Trout on their team. That's the point. That's the essence of Mike Trout. Our cackling is coming from, and I don't want to speak for you, Liz, but I feel like we're on the same page here. The cackling is coming from the satisfaction in repeatedly saying that this exact thing would happen to people who kept expressing unqualified assurances that Mike Trout would not only be available as a free agent at some point, but that he would unequivocally select the Phillies as the team he would go to, as though there was just some sort of guarantee in place to a system in which there are way too many variants to have any guarantees. So I'm more in that camp, that there are so many people, media people, respected media people, people calling into to radio sports shows saying, like, screw Harper, let's wait for Trout. And on the day Bryce Harper, the same week as Bryce Harper hitting 2 home runs in one of his first spring training games with the Phillies, Mike Trout decides, nah, I'm not coming. I'm not coming to Philadelphia. Now, granted, Bryce Harper did kind of stir things up by saying, I'm going to be recruiting Mike Trout. And I don't know about you, but my belief in something actually happening with the Phillies and Mike Trout went from about 0.1% to, I've been thinking about this all day, to about 2.5%, certainly not 3%. Believing it could happen. He did move the needle for me as far as the reasonable expectation that Mike Trout could be on the Phillies. But obviously, you know, it's back at 0 at this point. Did Bryce Harper's involvement do anything to make you think it was any more possible that Mike Trout would be on the Phillies at some point?
I mean, a tiny bit. Like, If it made me excited in that if he reached free agency, I thought that he had a good chance of, you know, I feel like if he'd actually reached free agency, the Phillies could have made a good case and might have actually signed him. Did I actually think that was happen? Friends, you can go back and into the archives of this show and of Hittin' Season and listen to me say at least 3 separate times, if not more, I think Mike Trout is signing an extension with the Angels.
Check the receipts, people.
Check the receipts, damn it. So I am glad Mike Trout is with the Angels. I wish he was with the Phillies. Of course I do. But, you know, I'm in no way disappointed. Dude got paid. And Bryce Harper was happy about it, too.
Everybody
was
thrilled
for him.
Yeah. This was a happy day for baseball. It was. For certain baseball players, it was a happy day. What do you think's next out there? Because as we talked about on the last episode of Hidden Season, they haven't really done anything with Mike Trout since he's been out there. He's played in one playoff series in his entire career, which is, I believe, what, 8 seasons long? 6, 8? I think 8. But even so, a significant passage of time has already occurred. What is the plan in Anaheim? Not to put you on the spot about a team we don't talk about or cover, but like, what's the plan out there to make keeping Mike Trout for $430 million in 12 years worth it?
That's a super good question, because the Angels really weren't active in any way this offseason.
Nothing.
They're, you know, they've got two players, and one of them they're paying $500,000 until for the next 6 years. So I mean, they can tell Mike Trout whatever he wants. I don't think he's with them to win a ring, if that makes sense. If he wanted to win, if he really wanted to win a World Series, he'd go somewhere else. I don't think he's stupid.
That's quite a take. I mean, do you really think he is the rare baseball player who is at the elite level? He has personally reached the top of the game. Isn't the natural progression to be like, all right, look, I reached MVP status. I've solidified my legacy to this point. Isn't this the point where he goes to get his ring, or is convinced that he doesn't have to go anywhere to get his ring? You don't think the World Series ring is in his purview?
I don't think it's that he doesn't want it. Yeah, I'm just trying to convey, like, I think he just wants to stay with the Angels. I think he's happy. I think he plays baseball, likes the weather, the Eagles, and is happy. Like, I think, you know, he could have gone anywhere, and yet he stayed with the Angels, who in his entire career, as you said, one playoff appearance, and have done very little to build a team around him. He's not
jack shit is the term that keeps coming to mind for me.
Exactly.
Just shit.
if anything, they've done somehow negative, a negative amount of stuff. Like, they've actively made their team worse in a number of ways. Jared Weaver was a pitcher for them for quite a long time. Remember that guy? He left for a year and then retired from baseball and then ran into a retiring Angel.
Let's go back and forth and name Angels players from contemporary era whose names we actually remember.
We're finished already.
Ben Revere.
He played for the Angels?
I don't remember. Yeah, so that's kind of where, I mean, you know, Shohei Ohtani, fine. But like, you know, the point is certainly valid.
Yeah, I mean, so I think he's just fine with the chips falling where they may. Like, he doesn't need to be a superstar. Does he want a ring? My guess is probably yes. Does he want to do it anywhere other than where he is? No.
Oh, well, that.
So he's rolling the dice on them being able to do it. And I think if they don't, maybe he'll be disappointed, but he's also going to have nearly $500 million.
That I certainly agree with.
If he'd taken the rest of his career earnings, he would have made $500 million. Like, we don't understand. The Trout family, Mike Trout in 30 years could be arrested for paying someone to send his fail son to college. Like, that's how rich he is. He's even richer than all of those morons. He could buy and build a college to send his idiot children to. Not that he would have idiot children, but just in the world where the children of rich people are shiftless idiots.
It's a solid projection. I'm gonna agree with that.
Like, this is, people don't think of athletes in this echelon. They're a different type of rich. No, like, they're richer than these people. He's so much richer. He will be able to buy and sell Felicity Huffman and William H. Macy.
And I'm absolutely, which would of course be the first things he reaches for upon receiving $430 million. But I'm of course with you on the fact that he never said outwardly that he wanted to go play anywhere else. So it's easy to see him want to, like, be glad he's there, like where he's at, and just want to be there. I totally agree with that sentiment. But that's why I'm so convinced they must have had some kind of conversation with him about what their plans are to win, at least even just have the backhanded luck to fall ass backwards into one World Series win for the rest of his career. I mean,
we've got 12 years to try.
That's what 12. Yeah. You know, the clock's ticking, man. All right. It's been 8 years already. And you know, the back half of that contract, like every contract of that length, isn't going to be Mike Trout. It's going to be late career Mike Trout. Now, you know, if anyone could prove me wrong on that point, specifically, it would be Mike Trout. But, you know, in the span of 12 years, a lot can go wrong, even to the best player who has ever played baseball. So, yeah, I'm just very curious about this because being as so many people called him out, you know, oh, you're rich, but you're irrelevant. I mean, yeah, that's the dream to be rich.
Oh, and obviously, not be on all people's these radars. People, you're talking about what was that, Skip Bayless?
No, the other one. The guy who was a polyp who fell off of Skip Bayless. That guy, I forget his name.
What the fuck is that guy's name? I don't know. We can't remember his stupid. I could see his stupid freaking face.
That sentient turd that crawled out of Skip Bayless's toilet, whatever his name is, he said that. Oh, congrats, you're rich and irrelevant. Which you are really reaching for insults when you're like, hey man, you got $430 million and nobody cares who you are. Fuck you. Like, okay, I'm so into that. I am so into that fantasy.
Mike Trout seems totally fine with people not knowing who he is. He's a basic dude. This is the vibe I get from Mike Trout.
Liz just called Mike Trout a basic bitch. Folks, this is Continued Success, your favorite Phillies and baseball podcast.
There's nothing wrong with that. The dude happens to play baseball really well, but I think he just wants to go to work and come home and do good things with his money and visit sick children and play baseball with fans in the stands. Like,
he's a simple man who wants to simply play baseball, then get into his private jet, fly to a private suite at an NFL football game, and receive every ball from the team when they score a touchdown, just like everybody else. He's just a regular blue-collar Philly guy.
He's kind of living the dream, honestly.
That's what I said. I feel like I've said this to somebody.
He gets to live in California. The weather is great. He makes a crap ton of money doing something he's really, really good at. And then he gets to come back to his home, a place where he does not play baseball. And everyone loves him. Everyone still loves him. Doesn't matter the contract.
I wrote something that mentioned something along the lines of he's living the dream of every recliner GM in every rec room in Northeast Philly or Jersey or wherever that's decked out in like old Phillies pennants. It's living the fantasy of that person. Like, yeah, I want to, you know, I'm living somewhere else, but I'm still commuting back to see my teams in Philly play. And also I'm still really good at sports and not just talking about how good I was back in the police rec softball league last summer, you know, like,
I mean, that's exactly the vibe I get from him, which is why I think that's why I kind of love him. You know, I'm glad he signed with the Angels. It makes me happy that he's getting what he wants and he's getting what he wants. And I don't even think I wonder how hard they had to argue for $430 million.
You know, it shows a lot of growth on our part, Liz, that instead of being like rabid, slobbery tongued, delirious, crazy people offended that Mike Trout didn't come here the way we had promised ourselves that he would. We're just happy that he's happy. And that shows a lot of emotional growth, I would say.
I agree.
Well, Liz, let's pivot to a bracket that came out today that on which you could most certainly find, I think, the opposite of Mike Trout somewhere among one of the seeds. And I want you to introduce us to this concept that came out today.
This is the March Badness bracket. This is the brainchild of our very good friend, Matt Winkleman. Hello, Matt. Thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for this. I look at this and I see these 7 years I spent at the Good Fight reduced to a bracket.
That sucks, man.
No, I mean, but it's, I tried to explain it today. It's like seeing, it's memory, it's bad memory. It's memories of bad times and good friends. You know, it's just hating on how bad the Phillies were and loving them anyway was what my whole life was about. And this is a bracket of bad Phillies players from 2013 through 2017.
And there's 64 of them, right?
And Matt cut a bunch. There were people that did not get included,
which is incredible because I see Patrick Schuster's name on here. I barely remember who the fuck that is. I mean, you think like there can't possibly be anyone missing. I'm very curious to know who is missing because 64. Oh, really?
Like Brian Bogusevic is missing.
Oh, yeah. What about Scott Podsednik? Did he get on here?
Oh, I don't think he's on here.
I don't think so either. He was a spring training signing. Yeah.
Remember that guy? Yeah. is Mike Fondo on here?
Kyle Kendrick's on here. He has a World Series ring.
Yeah, here's the thing. I don't agree with that. I don't necessarily – listen, this is Matt's bracket. This is all his thing. I don't agree with Kyle Kendrick being on here, if only because – I don't know if he's representative of how bad this period was and that he was always bad and managed to hide behind people who were better than him. Well, on a team like this, there was no hiding. He was just bad.
All right. I have a question and I asked this today. And folks, just to give you even like just a little bit of a sweep, we're not going to read you all 64 of these names. Maybe we'll mention them all in passing somehow, but we're talking about guys
of our favorite matchups, maybe.
Yeah. We're talking about guys like James Russell, Jeff Manship, Dominic Brown, Ethan Martin, Alec Asher, like all those guys that you just start naming and you and your friends start naming. And you're like, oh my God, that guy, everybody from Mike Adams to AJ Burnett to Michael Saunders. But like, Liz, when you go up and down this list, I asked this out loud today and I might have an answer, but who on this bracket is the best player on this bracket?
Best player overall or best player in there with the Phillies?
Let's say overall. Like let's say who on here do you look at for their whole career? Nope, that's too easy because the answer is Grady Sizemore. Let's say when they were on.
No, I don't think that's right, actually.
You don't think for their whole career, Grady Sizemore isn't the best player on this bracket? Who do you put ahead of him?
Hold on. I'm just trying to make sure the person, my answer is actually on here. Because the bracket, it's written very small letters in very small type. Come on. If Michael Young is on here, it's Michael Young.
Michael Young is on here. He's actually.
It's Michael Young.
Yeah, okay. All right. Good point.
Yeah. He was good. He was signed, right? He was signed because he was actually not bad.
You're right.
He spent like 8 billion years with the Rangers and.
And there were all those rumors for years that when Chase Utley would like miss time, people would be like, get Michael Young, just steal it, like make a trade for him. Cause he was like good. And we thought back then we could just sign all stars to be our replacements.
And here's the thing, man, it's weird how his defense really screwed him over. Cause I think he played third for the Phillies.
He did. He certainly stood next to third base. Playing it is a little, come on.
He hit 276 for the Phillies. 276, 336, 395. He had 8 home runs, 126 games. Like, it's not like his power was, there was no power at all, but he was never really a power guy. But, you know, he was serviceable. And yet, I have such poor memories.
I gotta tell you, I feel like the veteran.
So bitter.
This is separated into four sections. You got bullpen roulette, which is a lot of relievers. You got gone and wish I'd forgotten, which I think is real bottom of the barrel guys. You got trust the prospects, guys who came up through the Phillies system and never panned out. And then you have this veteran presence section, which I think is where a lot of the talent really lies. I mean, even Delmon Young was good at certain points of his career. Chad Billingsley was good. Joaquin Benoit was even at one point, he was considered like a hot reliever to have in your
bullpen. For that one year. Yes, he was.
Same
good.
With Michael Saunders.
And then
he was
old. They launched him into space.
Right. And Michael Saunders, same thing. I feel like the Phillies signed him after that good year he had with the Blue Jays. And then he evaporated into vapor. I don't know. Where is he? Where did he go?
I just brought him up on Google. He's just such a doofy face. I'm so sorry, Aaron Harang. It's just the Phillies picture for you is doof-tastic.
Did you know Michael Saunders' nickname was the Condor?
No, yet. That is most likely not true.
I didn't know that either. But in any case, all right. So those are probably the best players on here. Liz, who's your favorite player on here? Who did you like watching, even though you knew they weren't very good?
I mean, there's a different type of favorite. When you said favorite, it's sort of my favorite bad player. Then there's like someone I might have actually liked spending time watching.
Not someone who you look back on and think, oh my God, and like grow to begrudgingly love in a weird way. But somebody who while this era of Phillies baseball was going on, you looked at and you were like, oh, you.
That is a question.
I'll throw out my answer just to help you out.
Please do. Okay, I think I got mine. Go ahead.
I think I'm going to steal yours. Mine is Eric Kratz.
No, you didn't steal mine.
Eric Kratz was, I feel like he was part of the beginning of the rebuild, and there was still this idea that the Phillies could, you know, they were still closer to their winning ways than they were to their terrible ways. And there was this, you know, sort of a slowing pulse of belief that they could do something to get some momentum and make an impact somewhere. And Eric Kratz came along, and he was this like youngish catcher. He was a real Chris Coast story, you know, unlikely guy, gets the promotion. And then on top of that, his parents owned, you know, the Turkey Bacon Company of record in the Pennsylvania region, and they of course featured him in their commercials talking to a cartoon turkey. But since they obviously didn't have the rights to use the Phillies names, they would have to call him, aren't you, first of all, they'd call him by name because he was not very famous at all, so they'd have to have this turkey be like, aren't you Eric Kratz? And he'd be like, yeah. And he'd be like, aren't you the catcher for Philadelphia? Because they couldn't say Phillies legally. And it was just some of the best local commercials that came out of this era. And
shades of the Hunter Pence bread commercial where he was rowing a boat with freaking bread.
And Eric Kratz was just a good dude. He was a friendly guy. I think his teammates liked him. And he gave this vibe, like he would do that thing. Every time he hit a home run, he would cross home plate and like pound his fists together. Like up and down twice. And I don't know, he was here long enough to have like a signature move like that I remembered. So I don't know. I have an affinity for Eric Kratz.
I always loved him. He was great. Seeing him be successful in the Brewers last year was very gratifying.
Super.
Knowing that the Phillies sort of helped start his career as a backup catcher. Cause he's like a David Ross type. He's sort of a backup catcher, good character guy.
That's a really good point that like, yeah, I said a lot of the talent is in the veteran presence bracket, and just the other way to use that point is to say that so many of these guys that came up with the Phillies or were young when they were with the Phillies, he might be one of the only ones who made something of himself, who was like known to a national audience, even just for a brief period after being with the Phillies in this time period. I don't know how many of these guys went on to any kind of success afterwards, but you could make the argument that Eric Kratz actually did. Darren Ruff went to Korea and became just the god of baseball out there. Another story I absolutely love.
I don't think any of these guys are still playing. I don't know if any, it's a really good question, if any of these dudes are still playing. I don't know if any of them are. No, Freddie Galvis is, and he's my answer for the guy I liked to watch
the most.
That's
a great answer, yeah.
He came up, and within a week I had bought his jersey because I loved watching him play defense so much. He just had like this balletic grace to him that was very pleasing. He always looked very dance-like out there. I always loved thinking of him as sort of dancing around when he would catch, because he would always sort of extend very far.
Oh, absolutely. He was the most graceful defender we had seen in a long time. And we knew that when he was coming up through the farm system, that he was all glove and no bat for
no bat
like at all. But seeing him play defense, you could see why the Phillies bothered to bring him up through the farm system and use him. When he was announced as the starting second baseman on one of those years we were starting without Chase Utley, it was like exciting because we were going to see a prospect we'd heard about. It was also just like, oh man. Well, I hope that
this is where we are now.
That
I guess
Chase Utley offense is going to come from someone else in the lineup, because it's not going to come from Freddie Galvis. But his
And it actually didn't come from anywhere
else.
And
it did not. And they lost a lot. The end. Freddie Galvis, when he came up and I forget how many games it was, but he went like, I feel a pretty solid while before getting his first major league hit. Do you remember his first major league hit? Because I, for some reason, remember this so much and I love it.
It was something really.
We were still.
It's like right there.
We were still going to Phillies games at this point. This is what,
it was 2012. Yeah,
we were still into the idea that the Phillies could be good and it would be great. And let's go. Come on.
Because they had just been good.
Yeah.
They were good less than a year
exactly.
ago.
Exactly. So Freddie Galvis is like the new guy in town and we're all very excited. Let's see what this kid can do. And he's great on defense and everything. And he plays in the first series against the Pirates that year, but he goes 0 for 12 or 0 for 10 throughout the entire series. Never gets a hit, strikes out a couple of times, but mostly just can't get the good wood on the ball. And finally he comes up on April 9th. The Phillies it's their first home game of the season. They're playing the Marlins. And they are losing, unfortunately, and they do go on to lose the game. And he comes up. I forget. I'm trying to look up what inning it was, like what the situation was. It was the bottom of the seventh. He comes up. The Phillies are down 5-0 facing Anibal Sanchez when he was a pretty solid pitcher for the Marlins. There's two runners on base. This is the Phillies' like best chance at a rally. He is most assuredly their like worst hitter at this point, just because even just in those first three games, you're like, oh boy, we really need a hit here. Who's up next? Oh, the guy who swung and who couldn't get the ball where a defender wasn't the entire opening series. And he comes up, and there's this impromptu chant that just starts across the stadium, and they all just start chanting, "Freddie, oh, Freddie!" Yeah. Like gets louder and louder and louder, and he finally makes contact with one of the, I think like the fourth pitch of the at bat. He makes contact and it just knocks this RBI double, knocks in two runs. It's the only two runs the Phillies score the whole game. But like, as one of the writers of The Good Fight said at the time, like he must just be like, feel like he's like a foot taller today. Like he came through in that moment, broke through the no hit seal and had a whole stadium of people chanting his name. And he was like, how old at that point? Like 23 years old. Like, you know, he was our rookie. He wasn't the best rookie, but he was like our Phillies rookie. And like the crowd rallied around him and he came through and it was a great, great little moment.
That was wonderful. I remember watching that. It was magical. Mm-hmm.
Well,
it was just like the last little, the last little sprinkling of 2011 magic used itself up right there.
Well, we'll get to a few more of these guys, but we're going to take a real quick commercial break. We'll be right back after this. So Liz, we're talking about this bracket full of absolutely horrid Phillies players or, you know, fluctuating goodness. Let's say that deeply scaled in the bad direction. We have favorites, but like, did any of these names on here, who here can you like not even picture their face? They're so forgotten to you.
That's a really good question. Let's see.
You know, like I remember Philippe Allmand, obviously. I remember Darnell Sweeney. Oh, yeah. I remember David Buchanan. Certainly I remember Cameron Rupp.
Patrick Schuster.
That was the first one I was going to say too. I have no idea who that is. No idea. And I think Dustin McGowan and Adam Loewen are the same person, frankly.
Yes, I was actually, as soon as you said Dustin McGowan, I thought Adam Loewen is not the same guy. Colton Murray? Who the hell
exactly.
is that?
I don't know who that is. I have heard his name before. The name Andrew Bailey, I feel like I've never heard that name before in my life. That's one of the only ones that I don't even recognize the name. Like that could be a typo and wow. I don't know who that is. Kevin Correa is another one. Cause I mean, you know, Cedric Hunter started for the Phillies on opening day. Reed Brignac was like brought in to give the infield depth or something. Emmanuel Burris, for some reason, I remember he's from DC and he played for the Nationals. And that was like a little story that happened. He also had dreadlocks. I can't tell you too much about, or I can't tell you anything about Andrew Bailey. I don't have any nugget of any memory of a guy named Andrew Bailey playing for the Phillies.
No, like I looked him up because I thought maybe he's this guy that I remember. I'm like, nope, that is definitely not the guy that I was thinking of at all. Wow. he had a pretty good season for Los Angeles after the Phillies traded him. And he pitched 4 innings for the Dodgers in 2017 and was never heard from again.
Hmm. That's the
abducted by aliens.
That's the epilogue for a lot of these guys' stories. And they were never heard from again. Okay. You know, I think we mentioned earlier, I asked you who your favorite was when they were on the team. You had an affinity for them. But let's actually do the other one too. Who is your favorite to look back on and just sort of laugh that he was ever here? Because I have one of those that I just kind of realized, like, I've been mentioning this guy and certainly a particular moment of this guy's Phillies career for years. I bring it up all the time. I think it's my favorite reference point. And I don't think I realized that until just now when I looked at his name. So who on here did you love? Do you love to look back at how bad their time with the Phillies was?
Jeff Francoeur. That's a great one. I love in every way. I started off like just everything about his Phillies career. I love, because I started off hating him because he was Jeff freaking Francoeur. I mean, he was the Phillies killer for a long time with both the Braves and the Mets. Oh God. But you know, the Phillies signed him and he talked at one point in the middle of the season being like, I didn't realize I was the veteran until I realized it, until, you know, dudes started coming to me and I realized, hey, I'm the oldest guy here. He's like, and I think I kind of like it. And you sort of saw that. That was the year, his year was the year of that fight where Larry Bowa is in the dugout, just like, fuck you, at whatever, whoever.
There's Mauricio Robles, who quick pitched. Hansel Robles. God, I always screw that up. I think he was pitching for the Mets and he quick pitched somebody, and Larry Bowa lost his shit.
It was amazing. That was such a great moment. Yeah, I mean, and then there's the Jeff Francoeur pitching incident.
Oh yeah, a favorite of mine as well. Ugh. Yes, and
that was a 2016 season.
Chase Utley yelling at Bob McClure.
if I pick one season from my entire, you know, from my entire time, I think the 2016 season was something else, because that was, they managed to avoid 100 losses. What they did it.
I love that moment of Bob McClure probably out there like explaining, well, the phone's broken, so we can't get Jeff out of the game and he's got to stay in the game. And Chase Utley's like, what the fuck kind of horse shit, amateur hour bullshit are we doing here? And Bob McClure's just like looking at the ground like, well, I don't know about that. Like, I'm getting dressed down on television by one of my players. This sucks. And Chase Utley's like, I don't want to live on this planet anymore. Yeah, that was definitely a quality moment from this era. But the one I was referring to was Sean O'Sullivan, a very, very bad pitcher for the Phillies, who made some spot starts, did some terrible relief pitching for them. And the moment I'm always bringing up is when the catcher threw the ball back to him when he wasn't paying attention and it hit him in the throat and they had to stop the game because he had to sit there and like clutch his throat in pain after getting hit by a return throw. And you were just like, what are we doing, guys? What are we doing? I haven't seen that since Little League.
There are some truly bad moments. Good.
It
God.
Is funny to think that Kevin Franson is on this bracket. Who he is now in the Phillies broadcast booth, and we love him. He's so good. He's got all the enthusiasm that you want in a broadcaster. Just like a childlike, let's get him for the Phillies, and it's very, very endearing. But he's on this bracket, and you know, deservedly so. He wasn't a part of a lot of really good Phillies teams, and he didn't, you know, unfortunately contribute statistically too much while he was here. But, and this is included on the bracket, the hashtag DMyAss, which is a terrific moment for Phillies Twitter. And if you're listening to this, you're probably familiar with Phillies Twitter. Liz, was DMyAss, was that a story that involved you? Did you interact with him during that, or was that before your time?
Oh no, that was my time. I may have interacted with him. I remember when it was happening. I remember when it was going on in front of my eyes.
So somebody, I believe it was Crash Burn Alley, another Phillies website, was grading all the Phillies players over the last season, giving them letter grades. Very common, extremely common at this point among team blogs. And they gave Kevin Franson a D. And I think later in the offseason, you know, months apparently after Kevin Franson read that blog post, the Phillies made him some kind of deal, or they like gave him a 1-year deal, or he was rewarded for whatever he had done the year before. And he tweeted at the Good Fight, something like, how do you like the sound of that deal? Hashtag D my ass. And I think Liz, for some reason, I do think actually it was you who had to be like, I think there's been a mistake here. The Good Fight.
Yes. Oh God. Yes. That is exactly what happened. He tweeted. We're just like, this was not
wrong website. Wrong Philly site.
This is not. I'm sorry. I believe there's been a mistake.
Sir, we will not be D-ing your ass because you are targeting the wrong D, unfortunately.
I mean, we found out several years later that he has a sense of humor about it now because, you know, done playing baseball. He's got, you know, he's got at least one kid. He might have two now. You know, he's much more good natured than the guy who tweeted at a blog
as a hashtag. Like, I wonder,
he understood hashtags all those years ago.
I wonder if that D my ass hashtag has a wide berth on Twitter.
I wonder what does that mean?
I'm looking at it, and everything—it's all Kevin Franson related stuff. That's pretty nice.
that's great that it sort of now it's his personal brand.
That's his, yeah. I was going to say that's his legacy. That's very nice. Well, Liz, before we move on to our documentation of the 2009 season, very exciting. In this episode, I want us to just take a second. We don't have to say goodbye to the bracket. But let's just each say one name simultaneously. The first name you see when you – just to give the people one more sampling of the terrible, obsolete Phillies that are on this bracket. In 1, 2, 3, Brett Oberholzer.
Tyler Cadell. I almost said fucking Brett Oberholzer. That was almost the name that came out of my mouth.
Happened. Damn it. All right.
I don't know. I changed my mind at the last minute. I said, God, no, you can't say Brett Oberholzer. You've been looking at his name the whole time because you can't remember what he looks like.
Well, we are.
I should have said Casper Wells because seriously, who?
Casper Wells,
is
I feel
that?
Like he's another guy who had a problem with someone online based on their measurement of his abilities, which were, of course, low.
I think he pitched.
He did.
For
he
the
came
Phillies.
In and pitched during a game that was so terrible we don't even remember it for the position players who were pitching. That's how bad of a game that was. Yeah, not fun. Not fun. This team, these teams, those teams. It's over. Bryce Harper's on the Phillies.
It's over, which is why we can laugh. We laugh about it. We have a bracket about it. I feel weirdly cleansed. So before we go, who is your? I mean, the point of the bracket is to sort of pick your. You know, your one player that sort of personifies this era. Did you do the whole bracket or can you just
one
name someone?
Player who defines that whole era. It's a layered question because I want to go with like, were the Phillies defined by a farm system that didn't pan out? Yeah, partially. But they also didn't, no one was ever like, oh, Cody Ashe is the answer. No one was formally like, oh, Cody Ashe is the answer. Did they rely too much on their, honestly, their biggest problem was that they relied too long on the core that had grown too old to be effective. And none of those guys are on here. So for their veteran presence, I don't know. I'm kind of drawn to the veteran presence corner. And I want to say Delmon Young because he was somebody who was acquired to compile. He was intended to be like talent that was supplementing talent they believed was also still here. The most frustrating part of these years was when the Phillies were still considered salvageable when they weren't. And a lot of people could see that they weren't, but the team didn't seem to ready to acknowledge that. And Delmon Young sort of personifies that. by being talent they thought they could acquire to supplement that and like be one of the missing pieces that the team was just like one Delman Young away from contending. He wasn't there to like earn a paycheck and then maybe get another starting spot on a different team at the All-Star break. He was there to be a member of the Phillies, and that he was the choice for that. A guy who was known mostly for throwing his bat at an umpire in the minor leagues. And I guess, was he known at this point for that terrible throw when he was on the Tigers? Like during the World Series against the Giants, I believe it was Delman Young, like, went to just throw the ball from the outfield to home plate, and it maybe got 2 feet in front of him and trickled to the foul line. So I'm going to go with Delman Young.
It's painful to remember that. It wasn't, I mean, it was the Giants too, but that was like an embarrassment of athleticism, of movement, the very concept of movement.
But yeah, I'm going to go with Delman Young for that reason, that he's reflective of the Phillies' philosophy. That was part of the reason some of these years were as bad as they were.
All right, well, I have a final four, and I think I know what my answer is. I actually have a rare final four because, I mean, this is just who I want. My one of these 16 seeds, Jeff Manship, who sucked, but who him and his weird name was just something that the community fixated on, which is one of the reasons why I feel like he's an important player of this year. It's Jeff Manship from the Bullpen Roulette region. Casper Wells from the Gone and Wish I Had Forgotten, because I barely remember him except for that weird fact about him pitching and the fact that I picture him as Casper the Friendly Ghost in a baseball jersey.
Okay, that's a good one. Yeah.
From Trust the Prospects, it's Dominic Brown. And veteran presence is Kevin Franzen.
John Brown was playing in the Mexican League last I checked, but God only knows what happened to him.
That was a while ago. And when it came down to Jeff Manship versus Dominic Brown, and I think for me, I mean, it feels easy, but I have a good reason. It's got to be Dominic Brown, because he was sort of hailed as by everyone as the next thing, because the Phillies had held on to that core for too long, and there was nothing else to do but place unreasonable hopes on the players in the farm system, who just... they didn't have a prayer. I mean, Dominic Brown lasted longer than Freddie Galvis, who had at least a serviceable glove, but also much lower expectations. You have to wonder if Dominic Brown could have ever lived up to, you know, the expectations that had been set for him, and whether that was a factor in just how bad he was, in addition to the Phillies yanking him around a whole lot. But, you know, I feel like that personifies, the failure of that era in many ways, because, you know, again, the dudes who they held on to for too long are not on this list. So
it just made too much sense. The Phillies, the first person to leave that good Phillies team was Jason Wirth. And it just so happened that the prospect the Phillies hung on to through all those deals for Cliff Lee, for Roy Halladay, the one guy who was untouchable was Dom Brown. And he was an outfielder who could theoretically take Jason Wirth's job. They went with Ben Francisco. They went with some interim guys for a minute, but it just made too much sense thinking that, all right, yes, it's sad to see Jason Wirth go, but look, the Phillies are so good now. Their top prospect, who is going to be really good, happens to play the same position, and we can just slot him right in. And narratively, this story just keeps getting told. And you're right. Dom Brown was sort of our first lesson in that era of things don't always work out the way you want them to, in an era where things just seem like they kept working out most of the time. So I think that's a really great answer.
Yeah. I mean, the failure of this era was perpetrated by a front office who got complacent in winning. And, you know, for a long time, there was no reason to think anything would stop until it stopped immediately. And they're like, oh, shit, there's nothing under here. It's all empty. So, you know, Dom Brown, it's an indictment of a front office that traded a lot of things and held on to the one. I mean, I can't imagine the pressure on this dude. Dom Brown, from rumors we all heard, was a strip club frequenter. And it's hard to blame him, because what do you do when you go to work and everyone's like, he's the second coming of baseball Christ?
He's like, wait, I'm baseball Jesus. I got to get to a strip club.
And he goes 0-for-4 and he's still the hope of the Phillies and they won't give him the right field spot. And some Ben Francisco is starting instead of him. He's like, what's wrong with me? You know, it can't have been easy. And you, like I said, I wonder if there is any way he could ever have been successful with his tool set, because there's talent there. There's absolutely talent there, but the Phillies made damn sure as little of it was going to come out as possible.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. We talk about it all the time. Nobody can talk about Dom Brown without mentioning May 2013. Mm-hmm. Because we saw the Dom Brown we thought was always going to be there, but he didn't stay very long. And well, neither did these Phillies, which is good news, I think. And certainly good news for us, because while you were talking, Liz, I realized that you're talking about the front office and the mistakes they made in this period of time. Now, I know you are a fan of Ruben Amaro Jr. at this point, and I think the narrative surrounding Ruben Amaro has taken a healthy turn upward in Philadelphia. He is not a flawless GM by any stretch of the imagination. The Phillies' mistakes were made organizationally, but looking back, the moves he made on his way out really do a lot to redeem him. So it's fitting, I think, for us to, as we document the 2009 series on its 10th anniversary, that we begin with the arrivals and departures for that team following the 2008 season. And one of them, Liz, is that your buddy Ruben Amaro Jr. is named the general manager of the Phillies at the dawn of the Amaro era. Ruben Amaro was the favorite for the job, as part of Pat Gillick's job had been to find a successor. But Mike Arbuckle, an assistant GM, also had a glowing profile written about him by Jim Salisbury in the Inquirer. The day before the decision came down, Arbuckle was considered a long shot for the GM job. He'd been a scouting director and an assistant GM, but was part of the front office joining in 1992 that had drafted Scott Rolen, Jimmy Rollins, Chase Utley, Cole Hamels, Ryan Howard, and they'd gotten Carlos Ruiz out of their expanded efforts in Latin America. So
exactly what we just talked about. Wow.
Is that not crazy? I remember it's insane that this exists, and I've brought this up before, but there's a book, I don't know if it was self-published or what, but it's bizarre. I forget what it's called. I think it's called like 64 Intruder, because it's about the 1964 Phillies, and it's about like one pivotal play that made them swoon at the end. As if that never happened, and it just exists in this universe where the 1964 Phillies are good. So there is, I'm saying, a subgenre of Phillies time travel, time altering related drama to exploit if we wanted to write this up. I'm just saying that it exists. But in any case, Mike Arbuckle was scouting the players who had he had drafted who would go on to win the World Series, and he said, "I remember all these kids. I remember seeing Cole Hamels pitch at Rancho Bernardo High School. I remember watching Jimmy play in high school at his home park. If you hit a foul ball, it ended up in the ocean. I remember seeing Burl at the University of Miami and Brett Myers on a chilly early spring night in Jacksonville." This is a quote in a newspaper. It started to sound like a poem at the front of a book. Liz, your thoughts?
That is not a quote. That's the beginning of like a long ass Walt Whitman poem.
Yeah. I was like reading this article like, oh my God, not only am I wondering if we made the wrong decision, I'm convinced we made the wrong decision.
I mean, you got to look at it this way. You got Ruben Amaro with balls the size of watermelons, and you've got Mike Arbuckle with the golden scouting nose. You cannot combine them into two people. And so, you know, you pick the guy who's going to eventually negotiate a Roy Halladay, Cliff Lee, then Cliff Lee again deal. So
he probably wins some, you lose some, I guess. He probably slapped Mike Arbuckle in front of Pat Gillick, and Pat Gillick was like, oh, okay, it's Ruben. If I don't pick him, he's just going to do that to me. Well, Jim Salisbury wrote on how Arbuckle's efforts had built the team, but left the minors a little bare. And you're going to love this because it fits so It fits so much into what we were just talking about. Salisbury wrote, "But things are looking up in the low minors again, and Arbuckle's impact will continue to be felt when Kyle Drabik, Jason Knapp, Julian Sampson, and Dominic Brown arrive."
Oh, God.
Liz, who is Julian Sampson?
I have never heard of him. Like, literally never.
Weird, right?
Where did he even go? Like, was he part of the trade? What happened to him?
I don't know. I'm completely unfamiliar. And he says Dominic Brown. That name is widely known. Even Kyle Drabik and Jason Knapp to an extent. Yeah. You want to talk about guys you don't remember? Well, on November 3rd, word came down. Ruben Amaro Jr. was your new Phillies GM, Liz. The Philly-raised Penn Charter grad and Stanford alumnus was about to begin a journey that would see him characterized as a smooth-talking genius, a negotiator with fistfuls of cash and a buzzing phone, and an incompetent boob holding his phone upside down. Liz, you and I were responsible for a lot of the characterizations of Ruben Amaro over the years, I would say.
Yes, you were.
In pieces both fictional and non-fictional. What is your favorite version of him? The guy who was profiled in Philly Mag with under the headline arms dealer, or the guy he was by the end of his time in Philadelphia?
My favorite version of him is arms dealer. I love the brash, egotistical Ruben Amaro, I just imagine him smashing through doors, just like slamming them against the wall, walking like, "All right, I'm here to deal."
Yeah, just throwing a brick through the window. Yeah, I'm the same way. I think not that I'm the same way, like I'd throw a brick through a window. I'm the same way, and that's the version of Ruben Amaro I prefer. just feeling like we could get whatever guy we wanted at the All-Star break every year. Man, that's a luxury. Like, you were just, we're going to do something big. And it's like, the Phillies were like in the mix on a lot of guys with big names. And as a Phillies fan, I hadn't really experienced that as a cognizant adult. Like, I knew we had missed out on a ton of guys, but now it was like, all right, we need a right fielder, Fine. Let's go after that all-star right fielder. You know, like, yeah, a lot of it was Ed Wade on the other end, but at the same time, It was just cool to be a part of the action.
Yeah, his confidence was our confidence because he was always confident about everything. You know, he was never wishy-washy, I think, at least in my memory. I'm sure he said some, you know, middle groundy things that are always frustrating. But he was, you know, he never showed weakness, I feel, is something he said to himself a whole lot.
I feel like he has not a tattoo of that, but like a sign in his office that says it.
And he's that guy in person. I went to Baseball 101, terrible title, in 2011. And that was the year of the that weird East Coast earthquake. And they inside me and a bunch of women from Philly's Twitter, who I still know now. We were inside and they herded us out in front of the stadium. And Ruben Amaro in a black SUV rolls up, and I think someone was driving him. He rolls up, he gets out, he's like, "What's happening?" He's facing this huge crowd of women, huge crowd of female baseball fans, and just stands there holding court. He's telling stories, and you know, eventually, like T Mac and Wheels came out because there's supposed to be a session with them, and you know, they're over there sort of holding court with a smaller group, and they're like waving at each other and. Like, it was just that, and he was very, very charming, very easy, very good with people. Like, it was easy to see how, you know, negotiating with him, how that would be both fun and terrifying, and how he could very easily win people over.
Have you ever seen him appear on the Goldbergs?
I have seen a few times. I have seen a few of it. It's just,
that is so fucking funny to me.
He's got this this childlike innocence to his acting, but it's very, I don't know.
He's a natural. He's definitely a natural. So he doesn't sound like an athlete reading off cue cards. Like he's good.
Yes, the man has come full circle. The Phillies fired his ass. He took up with the Red Sox first. He went back onto the field. No one had thought of him as like an actual on-field guy in years, but he played baseball. He wasn't just a bat boy. He was an actual baseball player. And
it was on the 93. Yes, it was.
And I don't think did we talk about him last year at all?
I mean, we must have.
I don't remember.
But certainly not this glowingly.
No, but I mean, he remade himself. And now he bet on the Mets and won. Because they picked him back up out of the field and put him back in the front office as a special assistant.
Who would have thought that when we were like at our most loving of Ruben Amaro, that if someone appeared and was like, hey, what is that guy's future is to be not only a member of the Mets front office, but also a lauded network sitcom actor.
I haven't watched much of the Goldbergs, but every time I go visit my parents, they watch it. And every time I watch, I'm just like, this is so charming. It's so, it's so of its place and time. So many recognizable things. Even to me, someone who you know, visited the area twice a year for, you know, multiple weeks at a time. But it was things that are recognizable to me. It's very comforting.
There was an episode about one of the kids getting left behind by their dad by accident at Veterans Stadium. And I'm like, this extremely niche event happened to me. I have this relatable experience with these children, like down to the location specific. It's wild.
That's phenomenal.
Well, in any case, the beginning of 2009 was met by this news. The Phillies would be led by Ruben Amaro, and the image of him at 10 a.m. in his press conference in which he was introduced. He looked so vivacious and young. He started his front office career minutes after his playing career. He was originally brought on board by Ed Wade and considered a candidate for the GM job in Houston that Wade eventually got. 10 years of experience he had Amaro had his own front office, smiling like a dog that had finally caught a car. at this point, his job was pretty easy. He was inheriting a World Series champion team that was, for the most part, still intact. But despite all that, the 15-day window to negotiate with the Phillies free agents, salary arbitration with a ton of players determining the fate of left field, the scrutiny, Paul Hagan wrote in the Inquirer, will begin immediately. So I want to go back, you know, we're going to run out of time real quick here. But before we go, I do want to go over a couple more historic moments from this point there, because there were a couple of departures and arrivals. The Phillies fired their third base coach, Steve Smith. Do you remember Steve Smith?
No.
So I remember just laughing at how aggressive he was as a third base coach. He would send everybody. The Phillies in 2009 brought back their entire coaching staff except for one, and it was him. And
the guy who kept sending everybody.
That is a pretty personal, attack there, message at least.
You specifically were very bad at your job.
Mm-hmm. We were fine. You were not. Steve Smith drew the fans' ear by being super aggressive, and he also, Charlie Manuel didn't like him because he got ejected and suspended a couple of times to the point that the situation was considered, quote, tense between the two of them. Ruben Amaro and Charlie.
I automatically don't like him now.
Ruben Amaro and Charlie flew off to Dana Point, California to the GM meetings for the purpose specifically of driving from there to San Diego, where Smith was living, in order to tell him in person he wasn't coming back. And when asked for Smith's reaction to the news, Ruben Amaro refused to share it. Steve Smith was the only coach not invited back.
I'm going to guess his reaction was, fuck you.
Not great. Smith would go on to appear on The Amazing Race with his daughter, and they were eliminated on April 4th.
Oh, God. That's okay. Now I have a little bit more context because I was an Amazing Race watcher at the time. Yes, I remember this now.
Yes. Jimmy Williams also wasn't coming back. He was one of those bench coaches in 2008 who was really more of a co-manager. It's exactly how he saw himself. And I think Charlie Manuel was probably realistic about it too, because he was. And his departure was a personal decision and really surprised Charlie Manuel. Apparently, Williams had seen himself as so much of a manager that he and the Phillies had trouble coming to terms on his next season's deal. He wanted $1.5 million closer to Manuel's salary than a coach's salary. But Williams and Manuel had a really strong relationship, but they'd get into shouting matches, Manuel said. But Williams, who was hired in 2007, was the first one Charlie Manuel celebrated with after the World Series win in 2008. He's the first one he turns to and shakes his hand. This is from a Daily News column. No one is saying why, although there are some big hints out there. I haven't called him since he quit because I don't really know what to say to him, to tell you the truth, said Manuel, a twinge of sadness in his voice. I have a lot of respect for Jimmy Williams. He's a tremendous baseball guy.
I love how honest Charlie is, you know?
Mm-hmm. Like, not even on purpose, you know? Like, on purpose, too, but he just, you know, the way he's feeling, it's pretty detectable in a moment like that, you know?
I have no idea what to say to him since he quit. I don't know, but I still love and respect it, which is just, it's a very baseball thing, but it's also surprisingly sort of vulnerable and open, just stuff you don't quite expect. Yeah. That's what I love about Charlie Manuel.
Mm-hmm. So Taguchi also went away at this point. You know, he was 38 when he signed with the Phillies. I thought he was much younger. Yeah. he went on to, he obviously wasn't with the team very long. He actually went on to become a broadcaster in Japan, which I guess isn't that surprising. It's what a lot of ex-players do. Also Tom Gordon. This was the point when my relatives had started to refer to Tom Gordon as Flush Gordon or Flash in the Pan Gordon because his nickname was Flash Gordon. He was not really a valued member of the team at this point.
Gee, I couldn't tell.
Oh, yeah. And Liz, you'll be sad to hear, after 11 years and countless pregnancy scares, Pat Burrell was leaving the Philadelphia Phillies, signing a 2-year, $16 million deal with the Rays. And he left with the highest home run total in Phillies history, 251, behind only Mike Schmidt and Del Enos. I mean, third in Phillies history? I forgot about that. He was the first overall pick in 1998. And while his career was defined by a lack of consistency, he was a pretty solid 20 or 30 home run guy who had just doubled in the World Series in that pivotal moment and really contributed to them winning. So Pat Burrell just
missed that home run.
Just missed it. Poor Pat. So with him gone, the Phillies signed Raul Ibanez to a 3-year, $30 million deal from Amaro's front office and on December 16th. The Cubs had been after him, but felt he wasn't good enough on defense. And another suitor, Angels, had decided to try and fail to keep Mark Teixeira. and don't forget, this is Chan Ho Park was brought on board and pitched so well in spring training camp, he was made a part of the rotation. I don't remember that.
It happened, I guess.
And finally, we'll just read through the rest here. Chase Utley and Pedro Feliz had surgery on the same day, November 20th. Utley for his hip, Feliz for a herniated disc. Mid-March saw Utley and Feliz return. Utley, of course, ahead of schedule, with typical recovery time for his surgery being 4 to 6 months, and he came back in less than four. But Cole Hamels felt a tightness in his elbow and flew out of spring training to get looked at. And he was eventually pulled back as opening day starter, and the job was given to Brett Myers. And finally, the Phillies were linked to free agent Derek Lowe, who eventually went to the Dodgers, before signing Jamie Moyer after long negotiations to a 2-year deal. Pretty tense negotiator, Jamie Moyer, you think?
Aw. Do you imagine
going to the negotiating table with Jamie Moyer and just getting your ass handed to you?
I mean, I feel like his argument was, I was very good last year, and their argument was, you're 60.
Right. They just
that's
wrote
why
that
we don't want to give you what you're asking for. You were good last year, but you're also a member of the AARP and collecting Social Security. So
listen, Jamie, I hear you and we love having you around. But the thing is, and he just slides a little piece of paper across the table and he picks it up and reads it. And it just says, you're 60. Wow. Well, whole lot of history from this point in time. We haven't even gotten to spring training, which we will do on our next episode. For now, Liz, I was going to read to you a list of who were free agents in 2009, but I'm just not finding it interesting enough. But the only thing I will say is that Scott Podsednik was one of them. Oh, that guy. well, we thank you for listening to our latest episode of Continued Success. We will be documenting the 2009 Phillies season throughout the rest of this baseball season. Really looking forward to that. I think there's a lot of stuff we've forgotten about the 2009 season. It was 10 years ago. Don't forget to subscribe, download, and rate all of the podcasts that are part of the Good Fight podcast family, including Hittin' Season and The Dirty Inning, both of which I'm sure have new episodes out right now. And we will talk to you next time on Continued Success.